Before I became an outside consultant, I used to work for the Department of Defense as an intelligence analyst. And I sort of had a geek background when I was there about 4 years ago. And I noticed that the software that analysts used on a daily basis was very unlike the software that you and I use from our home computers. It was much bulkier, required really thick manuals, was really user-unfriendly. On top of all that, it didn't really help us do our jobs better. Even if it was user-friendly, it wasn't that good. And eventually I realized that it was because the people who made the software weren't really acquainted with the problems that we were trying to deal with at our jobs. They were made by contractors who sat in different parts of the country or maybe even the world. So I just thought that it would make a lot more sense that the people who made this software could see what we go through on a daily basis and ideally would sit right next to us as we did our job.
As I was reading your part of the book, it was a little bit of a V8 moment where, you know, you sort of knock your head and like, oh, why don't they just, a phrase that I can't stand, but why this disconnect between what frontline people are doing and what the IT people are doing?
My suspicion is that the government's attitude toward information technology is that it's something that's stuck in the basement, something that, you know, only really heavy-duty geeks have to deal with on a daily basis. And that was true maybe 30 years ago when we used computers to do things like predict weather patterns or decrypt phone calls or something like that. But today it's on the desk of every federal worker, and the government hasn't adjusted to that fact.
And you actually talk about the versions of the softwares were so clunky, it would take change of these versions of the software would be just glacial.
Right, yeah. There was an incident where I needed a very simple change to a tool that I relied on. Basically, the name of a country changed from one name to another officially.
Right.
And on the day that happened, I wrote to the contract manager and asked them to make that change in the software, and he said it would have to wait until the next version because, you know, he didn't have a contract to do that.
And so out of all this, you came up with the idea of a Peace Corps for programmers. Lay out the idea.
Well, the idea is that the government would recruit professional web developers to come out to D.C. for a short stint, a year or two. And these web developers would be embedded with federal workers so that they can acquaint themselves with the job that these civil servants do. And when they do that, they get an understanding of what problems they're going through, and they see how they use computers. That face-to-face interaction gives them a sense, it gives them a better idea of what they should make and how to tailor some software to the specific needs of those users. And they just spend a couple of years out there, maybe at one agency, maybe at a couple, and they just, you know, go to work and do some good stuff. And then eventually, when they're done, they go back to their previous careers. And the reason it's just a temporary thing is because I'm convinced that the people we need, they would sort of clash with government culture. They don't want to work 9-to-5 jobs. They prefer to work in the middle of the night, if possible. They don't want to go through background checks and that sort of thing. They don't want to wear ties to work. So,
and they're not going to be at some place for 30, 40 years.
Exactly. And I think it would be harmful to put them in a place where they weren't sure. Where they felt like they were making a big-time career change. I don't think that's what this is about. It's about taking real talent and sharing it with the government, not taking it away from the private sector, but just putting it on loan to the government.
So, Richard, talk a little bit, because you're actually in government, and does this speak to you? I mean, is this a concept that could actually be come about?
Oh, yeah. I was. This is one of the wonderful serendipitous moments when I was introduced to Matthew from a mutual acquaintance, Jonathan Cousins, and as you always do today, you kind of Google somebody before you meet them. And I read this article and said, "Wow, this resonates on a lot of different levels." which I can play out. The office that I run, the Office of E-Diplomacy at the State Department, was set up by Colin Powell, kind of post 9/11, post East Africa embassy bombings. When it became clear to leadership in the State Department that we needed to move from a Cold War profile, a paradigm of need to know, where you lock things down, keep them in silos, because the big bad Soviet bear was out there trying to get those little pieces, aggregate them, and figure out our secrets.
The old loose lips sink ships idea.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you kind of fast forward to today, where what we're finding is our inability to aggregate our own information, means that we don't identify, underpants bombers before they get on the plane. And it is, from an intelligence perspective, all the way down to how do we develop software packages within an enterprise. And this collaborative model, which I really came to know and appreciate. I spent the last year at a fellowship out at Stanford and spent a lot of time with, web-enabled software companies. And this model of launch, iterate, let your customers identify where you should next make your next change, rather than, lock the doors, come out 2 years from now with a very expensive solution that may not meet the problem.
And usually doesn't meet the problem.
Right.
And
right.
Particularly the challenge that government is often faced is, by the time this solution actually gets, you come up with this big bang theory, once that actually, you launch it, the problem has changed, it's evolved, because there's been a lot of time between then and now.
Right. So this, Matthew's, again, it resonated on a number of levels. One is to infuse the government with this vision of launch and iterate, Matthew's one of his key arguments too is that in government it's harder to accept the possibility of failure, whereas in Silicon Valley and in software startups, web enabled companies, you learn from failure, you move on. Failure is part of the iterative process. And again, there are limits to the amount of legitimate, thought out failure that government will accept. But I think stretching the limits a little and understanding that we can be better service providers and we can do what we do better if we adopt a little of that mentality. And the best way to adopt it is to see it at work and see the practitioners doing it.
Matthew, how much of this almost culture of fear, the total risk averseness, how much of that plays a role in this situation that you describe?
In order to get yourselves up to date with the outside world, you need to try things that you aren't used to doing. And when the government tries things and they don't work out, all the public hears about is that the government just wasted a bunch of money doing something stupid. And unfortunately, you don't hear too much about when the opposite happens. When things go okay and when we learn something a lot about something, it doesn't create the opposite of a PR disaster, because we rely on a contracting process to make software. The problem has to be really big before we can justify the expenditure, the bureaucratic time of getting the contract ready to go. So if this problem were really easy to solve, the amount of work it would take just to begin working on it would justify the time spent solving it.
Yeah.
So we need to wait for this problem to balloon out of control before it's worth spending 6 months of bureaucracy on. And that's what's happening with the watch list right now.
The basic function of what we do is to help move the State Department from this need to know to a need to share culture, which in effect is we developed a series of knowledge management and collaboration tools, which because they're not mandated have to be.
They have to be good. They have
nobody's
to work.
Nobody's going to use them because it's not like they won't get their reimbursement check for their travel if they don't use it. they have to find value in these products. And we've been lucky with developing Diplopedia, which has just crossed 11,000 articles. you know, the communities at state, which people can gather their, you know, gather around either a specific issue or commonalities to share information. The virtual presence posts, which allow us to reach out to audiences where we don't have a physical presence. And, you know, currently we're working to develop a, you know, a professional networking platform, which we're, as you know, for now called dubbing Statebook. But each of them, you know, we've done in-house, and we've done them on, you know, free open source products. So we've kind of developed them in-house, and we've tried to take that model that you know, that we appreciate so much from the web development community, which is, you know, don't gild the lily, you know, get something out that works, get a beta group that is willing to kind of work with you. You know, they'll deal with the bugs and tell you what's the next features you should be developing. And we, you know, launch, iterate, and improve, and then revisit constantly to see if our model, you know, should be changed. So
and learn lessons as you go on.
Right. So the communities at state, you know, we had built it on a very kind of one you know, web 1.0 approach, where we were basically the webmasters, and we're in the process of shifting it to a, you know, self-publish, and we will kind of help people with higher level issues, but not, you know, not be gatekeepers. So
one, it was because Diplopedia is very similar to the Intellipedia that the intelligence community uses, and I know they're at this place where there are a number of folks saying we need to mandate the use of Intellipedia across the intelligence organizations. And I always have been pressing them and saying, hold on, doesn't that just become all of a sudden there's another tool that people have to use? And it almost defeats the purpose of these things, it seems. How do you deal with that? I mean, eventually, you either say, okay, we're collaborating now, or, you know, or you're going to be left behind. How do you deal with that kind of issue?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think, you know, at least our approach in e-diplomacy has always been, you know, have the products prove their own value. And, you know, there are, you know, for example, some embassies that use a community as their channel to get information back to the, you know, the interagency audience that's following their issue. So, you know, Embassy Mongolia has a, you know, wonderful page that is actually built on IntelLink, so it's available to the interagency community, and it's a place where if you want any information on, you know, Mongolia that's relevant to the U.S. government, you got a one stop there, and it's searchable, and it's archivable, and it's not locked in people's heads. It's not locked in somebody's inbox, and you can, you know, read in if you're the new person, the new desk officer for Mongolia. You can go back and troll for information and find it, and you don't have to save your emails in a separate box from some newsletter that comes out weekly or monthly. And so it's just a better tool that has been very, very useful to them. And, you know, that came from a mandate. So, you need to have an ambassador or a, you know, deputy chief of mission say, look, we're going to move everything onto this platform. And if you send it to me in an email, I won't read it. And we're not sending emails back to the to the desk. We're going to put it on there. And so you know, at some point, you know, to make change management requires somebody to kind of make the decision.
How do you deal with the what I call the clay layer, what people have come to call the clay layer, the folks in the middle who just say, you know, I'm not doing this, right. And it moves the cheese too much.
Yep. No, that, you know, you have hit the nail on the head. I see this especially in spades now, where we have an administration and a Secretary of State who clearly have embraced the power of social media as a tool, both, you know, behind the firewall and outside of the firewall, and the, you know, leadership have taken their cue from from the Secretary of State and the President. And then you have the people who are coming in who are digital natives, and they, you know, this is like oxygen for them. It's the real challenge, and this is something we work and think about, you know, daily, is to show the value to the person who's, you know, been in the State Department or in the civil service or foreign service for 10, 15, 20 years, and, you know, they've seen the track to success, you know, getting into the, you know, senior executive service or becoming an ambassador, and you know, trying to demonstrate the use case that by embracing these tools, there's another pathway. That it used to be that your power was this, you know, being.
Hey, information was power, and we were more powerful if we had it.
Right, and to convince them that your power is put on steroids if you are connected to a network, because that information is all that much more powerful if you're networked.